Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion titled, How Coastal Cities Are Preparing and Adapting to Rising Sea Levels. Our discussion is moderated by WBUR's Bob Oakes and co-sponsored by the Boston University Initiative on Cities and the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. We begin with an introduction by Pardee Center Director Anthony Genatos.
Together with the late mayor, Tom Menino, and Professor Graham Wilson, co-directors of the BU Initiative on Cities, we've envisioned this event as an important opportunity to examine some of the threats that coastal cities face, but more importantly, to convene conversations about how to overcome these threats, to mitigate their effects, and enhance the resilience, the economies, and the livability of the great cities on our coasts. We're grateful to have participants and representatives from other great coastal cities in the U.S. and around the world, and to have the participation of the political leaders, policy analysts, engineers, architects, scientists and researchers, and the business community, all of whom have critical roles to play in envisioning solutions, implementing them, and learning from them so that we can improve them over time. We're in the heart of one of these great cities, of course, and the success of Boston University as a major research university and the other universities and colleges that are as much the fabric of this city as its neighborhoods is really dependent on the vitality and energy of Boston. We would do well to find solutions to the threats that the rising sea brings with it. Now, I can't talk about this event without a few personal notes about Mayor Menino. I only knew him during the short time that he was here at BU, but I'll also wager that many of you are here because he personally reached out to you over the telephone or at an event, a personal touch that was familiar to all lifetime Boston residents. I'm one of the lucky people who moved back to Boston after living away for a long time and remain astonished at the transformation that the city has undergone in the intervening decades, and I was privileged to be able to express that to the mayor. When he first arrived on campus, I was fortunate to spend quite a lot of time with Mayor Menino to talk about what he wanted to accomplish with the initiative and how we could actually work together. It was clear to me and in fact, to all of us in the BU community that what we will discuss was vitally important to him, that he cared deeply about creating the kinds of partnerships that could strengthen the city and help other mayors surmount similar challenges that they faced. In many ways, this conference embodies the vision that he had of the ways the university could contribute to the long-term vitality of Boston and to cities around the world whose fates are intertwined with an ocean that can be both nourishing and relentless. Tonight, we're pleased to be joined by Mayor Christian Bulwage from Elizabeth, New Jersey, Councillor Aaron Wood of Melbourne, Australia, to discuss the policies and politics of climate adaptation. Brian Sweat, Boston's Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space, is also here to provide remarks on behalf of Mayor Martin Walsh, who was unfortunately unable to join us. Our own Bob Oakes, host of WBUR's Morning Edition, is here to lead the conversation with the panel. To start the program this evening, I'd like to introduce Brian Sweat. As an appointed member of Mayor Walsh's cabinet, Brian leads the city's environmental and sustainability agenda. Most recently, he has led the launch of Greenovate Boston, a sustainability education and outreach initiative, and kicked off Climate Ready Boston, a set of climate preparedness initiatives focused on Boston's built and natural environment. Please join me in welcoming Brian to the podium.
Thank you, Tony. And I just want to echo Tony's remarks. When I was actually originally an appointee of Mayor Menino's, I joined his cabinet in August of 2012. And when he told me that he was coming to BU and when we were talking about ideas that would be phenomenal initiative on city subjects, this was one that I pitched to him, and he wholeheartedly endorsed. And you know, we were having this event in large part because of his efforts over his all very too brief tenure here. But he was a leader in trying to figure out how Boston could become better prepared, and certainly a mentor and a friend of mine, and thinking about him a lot tonight. I'm also really happy to continue in this role, and you know, Mayor Walsh asked me to stay on, and actually his first question to me after he was elected about a year ago now was, how do we make sure Boston gets better prepared for storms like Sandy? And this is an issue that, you know, Sandy was a near miss for Boston, but it was a wake-up call and folks appreciate how vulnerable the city is. And we looked at it as an opportunity to better communicate with the public, to motivate additional action, and to think about the long-term future of Boston, and think about not only how the climate is impacting us today, but how our decisions we're making today going to impact our ability to have a vibrant and vital and fun and sustainable city for generations to come. And I think we have made a significant amount of progress. The interesting part is, you know, Sandy is one of those storms that is, for us, it was a near miss. And I'll talk a little bit more tomorrow as well on this. But for us, we were about, I got a lot of questions after Sandy about whether or not what Boston's impact would have been had the storm hit directly into Boston Harbor. That actually turned out to be the wrong question. The storm was so big, it was about three times larger than the normal hurricane, and it wasn't even a hurricane as it hit landfall, that it was a question of hours, not of distance. If it had hit at our high tide 5.5 hours earlier, same trajectory, we would have had a 100-year flooding event in Boston. And that would have impacted about 6% of the city's landmass with some volume of water, and not just our waterfront wharfs. We're talking neighborhoods in East Boston and Dorchester, in Columbia Point, significant impacts from flooding events. That event was well covered, and we viewed that as a near miss, and we actually took a vote on gambling last week, and we will continue to do that in Massachusetts. We have had three additional near misses since then, and we've had, by a sum total of about 20 hours, Nor'easter Nemo, Nor'easter Hercules, and another Nor'easter, which also had a Disney name. And so we've had four near misses in 24 months. And so I'd say we are exceptionally lucky, but that's four near misses from 100-year flooding events, from the 1% storm in a matter of 24 months. Those storms got much less coverage, largely because they were also major snow events. And the reality is in Boston, we are far more likely to have a major flooding event in the wintertime based on the shape of our harbor and based on nor'easters and wind. The added challenge to that is the least effective time for our stormwater system. So folks are usually familiar with shovel out a hydrant, adopt a hydrant in case there's a fire. You know, we need to adopt a storm basin. We need to make sure that flooding events are able to be maintained and dealt with by our stormwater system, and that's the least advantageous time to be able to do that. We are well aware of other infrastructure in Boston that is highly at risk. Logan Airport, and actually the airport runways are fairly high, but it's the access to it. We have a phenomenal downtown airport on the waterfront. The access in terms of the tunnels and bridges and mass transit to get there are a significant challenge. In a storm event, landing a plane isn't enough. You need to be able to get the supplies to the cities and the citizens in need. Our mass transit system. We know from the experience in New York, and I'm sure we'll hear from Mayor Bolage, about the impacts on mass transit in the region. We know in Boston we have the oldest mass transit system in the country. We also have the oldest electric system running that mass transit system in the country. We know that that doesn't like salt water. It doesn't like any water. So we have issues with mass transit. We have issues with our electric grid. We're talking about sea level rise and storm surge. One of the concerns that I've been talking about with Councillor Wood extensively is the vulnerability of our electric grid, not only to storm events, but to extreme heat events. Most of our electric generation is coastal in this region and using either river water or ocean water to cool it. If there isn't enough temperature differential between that cooling water, we actually have to downsize the output coming out of power generation. This happened two summers ago when we had a heat wave of 5 days over 95 degrees, where the ocean water that's used to cool Pilgrim nuclear power plant was not cool enough, and they actually had to downgrade the output by about a third. So that's the exact same time that everyone is turning on the air conditioning. So the vulnerability of our electric grid being a coastal city, but not necessarily from a storm like Sandy or Nemo, is also of critical importance as we go forward. We are, you know, to sum it up, if the specifics don't scare folks enough, we are the eighth most at risk in the world from a financial dollar value to sea level rise and storm surge and flooding events, and the fourth most in the United States. After New York, which we'd be a small borough of, and these are absolute dollar amounts, Miami, which, you know, you can read about the flooding, and there was a great event with Senator Nelson and Gina McCarthy at the last King high tide, standing on Sunset on Miami Beach Boulevard in South Beach in water just from a high tide. And New Orleans, which folks know is about 10 feet below sea level. I usually like being in the top five, not on this list. But what are we doing? So yesterday we announced and released our draft climate action plan. We update our climate action plan every 3 years. and this one in particular, focus on community preparedness and climate change preparedness, community engagement and climate change preparedness. We know we need to prepare our buildings, our neighborhoods, and our infrastructure. We also need to prepare our people, and people need to be aware of the types of events and the storms that are coming down the pipeline. The first snowstorm of a season for Boston is always interesting. We tend to forget a little bit how to operate. But if I told you we were getting 2 feet of snow tomorrow, usually you'd say, okay, I think I left my shovel over here. I know where the salt is. I know where not to park. We are anticipating events coming down the pipeline in the near term, like hurricanes like Sandy, that we've never experienced before. And how do we prepare people to begin to understand how to make their homes watertight? To how to make buildings watertight. And I'll show some slides tomorrow. We now have buildings, existing buildings, that are saying, how do I become watertight in the event of a storm, and understand and practice that? We should not wait for the storm to hit before we start to appreciate and practice best practices to get ready. So the Climate Action Plan is released for public comment, has significant climate preparedness segments. It is also well coordinated with a number of other city planning efforts underway. Go Boston 2030, which is the first major mobility visioning that Boston has done in several decades, to envision how folks want to get around the city, moving people and goods rather than vehicles in 2030. We released a housing plan. Mayor Walsh released a comprehensive housing plan calling for 57,000 new units of housing by 2030, as well as a natural hazards mitigation plan. Climate preparedness is integrated into all of these because we need to make investment decisions today, understanding what the climate will be like throughout the life of that investment. Two highlights before I turn it over to Mayor Bolich and Councillor Wood. Regional Climate Preparedness Summit, we announced on Wednesday. As folks in the room probably appreciate, we have fairly small cities and towns in Massachusetts, and we don't have a strong county structure. Storms know no boundaries, and we need to start thinking municipally from a regional perspective. And Mayor Walsh called for the first municipal elected official, so his contemporaries of the 13 cities surrounding Boston, the 12 cities plus Boston, of the Metro Mayors Coalition around climate preparedness, which will be hosted down the road at UMass Boston, a fitting location on Columbia Point, to talk about regional collaboration and coordination around this with state agency officials, with federal agency officials, and most importantly with elected municipal mayors who understand that we are at the front line of dealing with climate change and from both the long-term perspective and the near-term disaster preparedness. So that'll be in the spring of 15, and we're working on what is the right coordination mechanism going forward so that all of our vulnerability assessments and our plans and infrastructure are well-coordinated and collaborated, and we can envision and prepare for our future. The last item I mentioned, which was also announced on October 29th, which was the second anniversary of Sandy, is our Living with Water International Design Competition. And using significant track record, I don't know if folks in the room saw our canal plans for the Back Bay, and I am joking, but we it was above the fold. A good rendering is a phenomenal press getter. And we envisioned and challenged the Urban Land Institute to have a charrette, and they work with the Boston Harbor Association on this project to think about Boston plus 7 feet of sea level rise. So on the 29th, we announced an international design competition on three specific areas of Boston that are near-term vulnerable. And these are the Prince Spaghetti Building, which is a great existing building in the North End, the 100 Acres Master Plan area, which is in the Four Point Channel, and the Morrissey Boulevard at the connection with Columbia Point. So three major areas that we know are vulnerable today, and we are seeking, similar to tonight's panel and this conference, international expertise and international solutions, because we in Boston know that if we look outside of our borders, we are likely to find something that we can learn from, both in terms of what has worked and what hasn't, and be able to envision a future of Boston that embraces climate change as an opportunity that we seek to address in making Boston more vital and not as a challenge that we run from. So with that, I am excited to hear from the other cities that are represented here and begin a conversation. And I thank the Pardee Center and I thank Boston University for hosting this. This is the first major university event around coastal sea level rise preparedness that I'm aware of in the Boston area to bring folks together and develop a plan. And I would highlight that this is the beginning. I know we'll have a conversation in the last session tomorrow about the role of cities and universities working together to find solutions to this. And I would end by saying this is a collaborative challenge, and it is going to require a collaborative solution. So I look forward to the conversation tonight and continuing the session tomorrow. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Let me introduce our next guest. Christian Bolwage, mayor of Elizabeth, New Jersey, leads one of the largest cities in New Jersey, the only one to be named among America's 50 greenest cities. This year, he announced new greening initiative, and he leads the way in urban brownfield renewal, serving as co-chair on the U.S. Conference of Mayors Brownfields Task Force. A lifelong Elizabeth resident, he's been mayor for 22 years, calling to mind the civic devotion of his friend Tom Menino. Elizabeth is home to Newark Airport and the Port Newark Elizabeth Marine Terminal, one of the busiest ports in the world. Like many of Elizabeth's neighbors, the city was directly impacted by the tidal surges of Hurricane Sandy. Please welcome Mayor Bolwage.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be here. And when Tom passed away, I made a phone call and I said, you know, is this conference still on? And they said yes, and I said, well, I'm still coming then in Tom's memory. I met Tom some 20 years ago, and we developed a very close friendship. He's been to Elizabeth trying to get urban enterprise zone legislation passed through the Massachusetts legislature, and he returned the favor. I came up and sat with him at a game in Fenway a few years back, and we just enjoyed each other's company. And I want to thank the organizers, and I hope you can continue Tom's work for years to come. He truly was a special mayor. When you talk about Hurricane Sandy, and when Tom called me in September and asked me if I would join this panel and talk about impact on coastal cities, I said, sure. I said, no problem. Who's coming? He said, well, me. I'll be here. So it's good enough for me, Tom. If you're there, I'll be there. But when you look at Hurricane Sandy and you talk about the impact, and I was listening to the other comments when you said it was a near miss here in Boston. Well, it wasn't that way in New Jersey. You know, it hit land 60 miles south of my city. And there was not a lot of rain with Sandy, which caused an interesting process in dealing with the problems that existed, because it was strictly flooding. And it was flooding from the surge. It wasn't flooding from a lot of rain. We're the Arthur Kill. We're the largest seaport, container port on the East Coast is Port Newark, Port Elizabeth. Sealand, Mar terminals all bring in containers there across the Arthur Kill of Staten Island. Then you go into Brooklyn. It's a massive waterway. So when you talk about the surge, and what I really want to talk about in the beginning is the surge caused electrical outages. 51,000 electrical accounts in my city, 49,000 were without power on the day of the storm, I being one of them. My first phone call was to the public affairs person in the public service company. I said, I want to let you know I have no power. And they said, okay, Mayor. But I said, I also want to let you know I need to be the last one turned on, which really pissed off my wife, but because my wife and daughter had to then live somewhere else while I stayed at the house and went back and forth. And sure enough, 12 days later, when everyone else had their power back on, my power came on. But what was interesting about the grid process in New Jersey is, and the communication with the electric company is, they could never tell you when your power was going to come back on or how long it would be off from, because they have no idea what is connected to what. You know, the old story we used to hear when we were kids about your hip bones connected to your leg bone and that story you grew up with? Well, the power company has no clue. They really don't. And I've said this in New Jersey, and I don't know if you have this problem in Massachusetts, but we'd call up and we'd say, you know, what's going on with the power on such and such a corner? And they'd say, well, it's connected to this corner. And I'd say, well, but that corner has power. Oh, well, it's somewhere in there, Mayor. And so the phone calls and the dynamics that were going on, we had conference calls at 10 o'clock every morning with the power company, which turned out after 4 days to be absolutely useless, because not only were they telling the mayors one thing, when constituents were calling the power company on the hotline that they set up, they'd tell the constituents something completely different. When downed wires were in trees, we cleared away, our public works crew cleared away all of the trees, but we were told not to touch the wires that were in trees. So The power company would tell the constituent, well, the reason we can't fix your power is because there's a tree down in the middle of your road. Then they'd call me and I'd say, well, we can't move the tree because the power company told us not to touch it while there's a wire there. So that went back and forth for a good 2 weeks, and I can tell you there were a lot of downed trees and wires, and it just kept going. So our frustration dealing with Sandy was mostly with the power company, Public Service Electric and Gas. The surge and the water flooded the system. As I don't know if you have it here in Massachusetts, but all of our connections and our lines are underground. They're not. We have telephone poles, but the main source of the transmitting of the power in a lot of areas is below ground. And when they're flooded out, in order to get there to repair it, became extremely difficult. I was out that night on Sandy on the Monday night at 9 o'clock, and I'm driving on our waterfront, and my daughter, who is now 14, when I left the house, she said to me, and Dad, why do you have to go out tonight? I said, I don't know, Jacqueline, that's a really good question, but I think I have to be out there somewhere. So I'm out there, and I'm in the middle of an area on the waterfront, and all of a sudden I hear, help, help. And I'm like, there's 4 feet of water between me and this guy screaming on the roof of the car. The fire department responds. They put up an inflatable raft to go out there to get the guy. The raft blows away. They can't get to him. This guy's still screaming. The water's climbing higher. The next thing you know, we have a human chain of people. I'm not included, by the way. I'm the mayor. I have no idea about how to save people. So I'm standing there watching, and they have this human chain along a fence so they don't fall in any open sewer grates, and then they walk this guy out through four and a half foot of water. The water damage was severe in our city. Our waterfront, our bike waterway, our bike and walkway path on the waterfront, as well as a recreation pier, was basically destroyed. And we've done a whole bunch of stuff to put it back, you know, piling and things. And we're working with the Port Authority in order to redevelop some estuaries where possible. But commerce is extremely important in our area. So you can't evacuate everybody from coastal cities. You can't evacuate people who live on the water. The only way that we deal with these tragedies is through planning evacuation and planning for solutions. And making sure, I mean, I've got to tell you, we've been investing in more generators since this storm hit a couple of years ago in our recreation buildings, and making sure that people have the ability to locate in an area if they get locked out of their home. Senior citizen buildings, you know, when you got a couple of hundred people in a senior citizen building and they have no power, it's extremely difficult. Where do you get blankets, you know, when it hits in October? We weren't prepared to have all of these blankets. So the Red Cross helped out and brought in a lot of, I'm not a fan of the Red Cross, but they helped out and brought in a lot of blankets and were able to give the seniors some blankets to begin with. So the preparation, like the gentleman before me spoke, is immense. And I got to tell you, we learned more in preparation after the storm than we ever did before the storm. And I was the mayor during 9/11 as well. And our fire department went over to Manhattan to help in that area. You learn more afterwards in order to prepare for the next one. And guess what? We probably won't be here for the next one. But anyway, we're prepared. I can tell you that. We have blankets. We have cots. We have generators. And there'll be stuff built that'll be far advanced than the stuff we bought today to prepare for the next one. It's an interesting dynamic until you go through it. I'm glad it was a near miss in Boston. It wasn't a near miss in Elizabeth, though.
Next up, Aaron Wood, city councilor from Melbourne, Australia, chair of the environmental portfolio, deputy chair of the economic development portfolio. He joins us on behalf of the city and Melbourne's Lord Mayor, Robert Doyle. Councillor Wood has made the environment his life's work, both as a member of the city council and through his environmental education program, Kids Teach Kids. He represented the city at the last C40 coalition meeting, a network of cities jointly tackling climate change. Melbourne was one of the founding members of the Delta Cities Network, made up of leading coastal cities at the forefront of climate adaptation and innovation. Councillor Aaron Wood.
Thanks very much, Bob. I should say g'day, really. We don't always say that, by the way. Sometimes we say hi, sometimes we say hey, but I'll say g'day. Thank you for having me. I've got to thank Boston University for inviting me over here. It's a beautiful city you have. And I think the exchange that I've had with the city of Boston as well in spending time with Brian, he has packed my dance card very, very full, and my head is spinning from all the sorts of ideas on how we might continue that exchange. I always sort of hear that introduction, and that's a kind introduction, Bob, and I have to qualify that with the fact that my father was my elementary school principal, and I spent more time in his office than any other child, and it wasn't for Gold Star Awards, I can assure you that. But he now works for me on minimum wage for kids teaching kids, so I've had the last laugh. What I want to talk to you about is an issue which I guess is an issue that, when you look at it in the cold light of day, it's an issue which you're glad there's adaptation and preparedness occurring. And I had the pleasure of visiting the Spalding Centre, was it yesterday, Brian? The days are all rolling into one a little bit. But I had the pleasure of visiting that centre, which is just an amazing resource. You know, if I have the insurance up to date and I injure myself, that's where I want to rehabilitate. But you think of the fact that they've factored into their whole built environment there a sea level rise of 3.5 feet. So the difficulty that we have in Australia at the moment is the national discourse is so confused, I guess, about whether climate change is real, whether climate change is happening, that impacts on the ability of us at a local government level to actually talk in a reasoned and objective way to our residents. I subscribe wholly to Mayor Bloomberg's view on things that cities act and nations talk in respect to climate change. He is tempering that language somewhat because he agrees that it's a little bit antagonistic. So he's saying that cities act, nations talk, and we can help them to act is the bit that he's added to it. So ever the politician, Mayor Bloomberg. We are lucky enough to be part of the inaugural C40 Cities Network. We've also recently been selected as one of the 100 resilient cities for the Rockefeller Foundation. I did an interview on that on our right-wing radio in Melbourne, and one of the talkback callers asked whether it was a conspiracy theory for the Rockefeller Foundation to take over the world through local government. I assured him that that wasn't the case and that we were very happy to accept the funding for the Chief Resilience Officer position. We have been really successful as a local government in terms of building strategies around the key threats that we face. Unlike Boston, we are not immediately on the ocean. We're effectively back off a protected bay and 3 or 4 kilometres up the Yarra River. But what we've seen even in the early onset of climate change is higher intensity rainfall events that cause overland flooding. We then combine that with a riverine flooding event, a king tide in the ocean, and that's where we start to have some fairly serious impacts. So a little bit about where Melbourne's located on the screen there. You can see Melbourne, the city of Melbourne is actually the smaller centre core, I guess. It's the 33 square kilometres of the central business district and some surrounding suburbs. We have about 120,000 residents that base themselves in the inner city, so quite a bit smaller than the city of Boston in terms of population. But the greater Melbourne area, if you ask people where they live, they all identify that they live in Melbourne, and that's some 4.2 million residents. We have about 850,000 residents come into the city each day to use it for business, for tourism and the like. So there are major infrastructure issues just in combating our population growth. So one of the things, we're very lucky in the fact that we've been judged the world's most livable city for the fourth year in a row. With that, though, comes great responsibility and something that I've been lucky enough to get the mayor to start sprouting. You plant the seed and then your mayor says it, and it's a very good thing. He now says that we're one of the world's most livable cities, but to remain in that top five. I like that, Brian. The top five is that we really need to become one of the most sustainable as well. So in that is a huge risk in terms of sea level rise and the impacts on our infrastructure and our assets. But there's also a huge opportunity to reimagine and redesign areas that are better for people, that turn water into something that's not a threat, but something that which is an asset in the driest inhabited continent in the world. So what we have is an interesting issue where we don't have enough water for most of the year. And then when we do get our rainfall events now, we have too much of that water. And the drainage infrastructure that was built on previous conditions is just not keeping up with the current conditions. So who's been to Melbourne, by the way? Excellent. For those of you who haven't, we welcome you with open arms. Brian and I are working on a direct flight. We hope to have that up and running soon. We just heard that they had a direct flight to Dallas, so it is possible. We can make this happen. But we're essentially at the bottom part of Australia. We're the second most populous city in Australia to Sydney. We're the best, but we're the second most populous. And essentially, as I said, the residential population is in the order of sort of 123,000 people. The interesting thing about it, though, is now, because of that livability status, it's one of the fastest-growing municipalities, in fact, the fastest-growing municipality in Australia, and that does present some growing pains and challenges. So in terms of the sorts of issues that we're facing, essentially, they can be broken down into a few key areas. Sea level rise, obviously, more intense rainfall events. We're looking at a 0.6 to 0.8 metre sea level rise by the end of the century. Increased likelihood of severe storms and flood events. But the interesting thing for us, and I think this is the same for a lot of US cities, is we had the Black Saturday bushfires in 2009, and they were a horrific event. I believe they got coverage in the States as well. We lost 176 lives in those bushfires. In the lead up to those bushfires, there was a heat wave that was a week long, where we had a week of over 40 degrees Celsius in the order of 104 or 105 degrees Fahrenheit. And in that week leading up to the bushfires, we actually lost 373 lives due to heat-related illness. So for us, the silent killer is actually heat. So once again, when we're looking at overland flow and the sorts of threats that poses to our infrastructure, it also presents a huge opportunity for us to cool our city, and I'll touch really briefly on that as well. So this is one of our major streets, and this is an overland flow event. This is from a rainfall event. But what we're finding is we're getting our drains backing up where we've got a high river and a king tide in the bay, and the drainage infrastructure is just not coping. Really good if you're a canoe enthusiast, not so good if you're trying to get to work on a Monday morning. In terms of what we're doing, and really now we're looking at the term resilient. What is a resilient city? How do we actually build extra capacity in the system? How do we bounce back from threats like heat waves and bushfire? We don't have the Hurricane Katrina's or Sandy's. We don't have that kind of big impact in terms of our sea level rise, and so it's going to be a real slow creep, and that's much harder to get action on. How do we actually get action and build a more resilient city? So these are some of the strategy, and I'll just touch on them briefly, but the urban forest strategy is where we look at that that threat or that waste product, if you like, which is essentially a rainfall event. We only capture 1% of the 500 billion litres of stormwater that actually falls on the city of Melbourne each year. And what that does is obviously cause a huge amount of issues and presents a huge opportunity for us as well. So our urban forest strategy is all about cooling the city by 4 to 5 degrees by planting 3,000 trees a year. We're 12,000 trees into that. We've got another 30,000 trees to plant. But what we know is the city is 4 to 7 degrees hotter than the surrounding greener suburbs. So if we can capture that stormwater, use it on our parks and gardens, we can grow our tree network, cool our city, and make a healthier city as well. This is the sort of scary data that we're getting. This is a 1 in 100 year storm event, again, a rainfall event. Those measurements on the side that are difficult to read, the lighter area is a 0.2 metre flooding. It goes up at the darker end to about 2 metres. That's the current situation. when we look at climate change, that's the sort of scenario that we're looking at. We've identified just alone in the South Bank area, which is a downtown precinct of Melbourne, that we've got about $80 million worth of drainage works that have to go in there. But what we're going to do is, with those other strategies, the open space strategy, the urban forest strategy, the climate adaptation strategy, what we're looking at is not just engineering solutions, not just big gates, not just bigger pipes, is we're looking at green infrastructure and the role that that plays in slowing down the rate of flow, in capturing overland flow, and mitigating against some of those impacts. That includes in a build-up city where it's very difficult to, obviously, we've got 77,000 street trees that we manage to keep on adding more and more trees in a highly urbanised environment. So we even partnered with the University of Melbourne to launch the Growing Green Guide, which looks at using our rooftop spaces, our walls and our facades, not only to green and cool the city, but also to capture that stormwater again so that it doesn't enter the stormwater system. So this is a new project. This is the Elizabeth Street catchment. It's wholly located within our city, which is great. We've got some good jurisdiction over it. And what we're looking at there is we're actually mapping. At the moment, it's rated at extreme flood risk. We want to bring that down to high, which would be a really good result. And we're going to, as I said, again, use all of our strategies, open space, urban forests, the climate adaptation modelling, and see what green infrastructure can do in terms of bringing that flood risk down for our city. It's good for the city because it makes it look good. It's good for the health of the residents because it cools our city and then it removes that threat of flooding. So often these green infrastructure projects have a lot of wins to them. So what we're looking at, obviously, is the doubling of the canopy cover by the year 2040 to cool our city. But what we're also then looking at is stormwater capture. We're looking at how our city is actually irrigated. As I said, we're looking at our open space opportunities. We're even looking at building that into the planning scheme then in terms of the flood risk that it relates to. This is one of our stormwater harvesting units. We've got them in our parks and gardens. We've got them under road. At the moment, we're at 25% of our water is now reclaimed, so it's stormwater. And in the coming years, we want to drive that up to 50%. So what that does is it insulates us against future droughts. And it was in response to a 10-year drought that we'd had in our city. And just a couple of weeks ago, we had a delegation from LA come out to learn our response to the drought because they are 3 or 4 years into their own drought. So I think to sum up that we don't have all the answers. We're still working through with our academic institutions, and research and data are extremely important. If you can't measure it and you can't understand the numbers, it's very difficult to form strategic directions, and it's very difficult to convince the finance department to actually fund these things. But they really do stack up when you look at the full cost-benefit analysis. So we're moving forward with a lot of these initiatives, and we'll keep on learning as we go. But we really do think by reasoned, logical planning that many of these threats that we face from climate change can actually be mitigated as best as possible and deliver a huge range of amenity outcomes for our residents as well. Thank you.
You all, in your presentations, all three of you sounded fairly optimistic in terms of your forward-looking approach to dealing with these issues. But reality check, if we might, for a second here. Let me cast the skeptical journalist's eye on this and ask you this question, all of you. Given that all your cities are dealing with issues of daily life, public safety, improving schools, picking up trash, beautifying public parks, fixing potholes, where is the threat of sea level rise or dealing with stormwater runoff actually in the list of priorities in your cities? Mayor Bulwich, why don't start with you?
Sure.
It's a mindset. It's a thought process. What happened in the city of Elizabeth in dealing with Hurricane Sandy was preparation because we thought about it. Are we thinking about it today? No. Are we thinking about it if the weather forecast says that Hurricane Sandy or some catastrophic event is going to take place in 7 days? The answer is yes. I mean, we had ample warning on Hurricane Sandy in order to prepare. We were able to relocate people that were on the waterfront. We were able to get them off of the water. We had people standing by that evening to get people off the waterfront further up if we had to. We put them in recreation centers and had cots in place. So we had warning on Hurricane Sandy, and the mindset was that public safety was going to be first and the lives of our citizens were going to be first. And then we would deal with the aftermath of the public service problem, the aftermath of the water problem, the aftermath of the streets that would buckle, or the recreation pier that was destroyed, which still isn't fixed, but it will reopen again this summer. So in answering your question, Bob, it's clearly a mindset, and it becomes a priority because with technology today, we can be prepared and know that something like this is coming.
All right, politics and skeptics. How tough is it to sell the need to focus on sea level rise, on climate change, when you're dealing with local, regional, national politicians who are skeptics? Aaron, why don't we start with you?
I might kick off on that one, because sadly we went from a country that was absolutely leading on climate action to pretty much the global pariah, which is not a place that that I like to be in. I think our best friends are Canada now, and that's it, really. So we don't have too many other friends on the national stage and the international stage. I guess what that does is it makes much of our city strategies and targets a little bit more difficult, because rhetoric in the environmental space is just as powerful as dollars, just as powerful as on-ground action. The way you speak about how you're going to prepare for climate change, about it being a huge opportunity to rethink things rather than just talking about the doom and gloom, I think is really important. So having a national discourse which is far from positive in this space is not helpful in that sense. In a real sense, it starts to impact on things. We had a fantastic working carbon price. It was driving down emissions. We've axed the tax. There's actually been no saving because there was an increase in electricity prices anyway, so it's quite a farcical situation. We have a renewable energy target, which has been doing wonderful things in terms of renewable energy generation. Federal government is after that as well. Now, where that impacts at a local scale is we have a renewable energy target for our citizens because they actually want to put rooftop solar on. We're the ones that they come to when the prices go up for solar. And I think that's the issue, is that local government is very close to the people. Federal government can make these decisions, state government can make these decisions, and we'll be the ones that they come to and ask why. So I think that the national discourse is very important to what cities can achieve. But again, I also put my eggs in Mayor Bloomberg's basket a little, which is not a bad basket to be in. He's been pretty successful. Is that cities have an amazing opportunity to continue to act and almost to continue to show national governments, which almost aren't structured to be able to deal with this kind of stuff, to show national governments a way forward, which is actually positive for the economy, positive for the environment, and positive for the people. And I think that's a great opportunity for cities.
But in the meantime, if I might, you have to deal with your Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who has dismissed evidence of climate change, his phrase, not mine.
Climate change is crap.
Absolute crap.
He's very eloquent.
Yeah. He disbanded an environmental agency set up to provide information to the public. It's got to be a little disheartening.
Yeah. Yeah, look, absolutely, and this is not just a public office role for me. This is my life's work, so it's another level of disheartening. What's more disheartening about it is that I come from a small regional town, which is an agricultural town. We're big into vineyards and dryland farming. And when we went through a 14-year drought there, my mother is actually a social worker, and one of the roles that she undertakes is counselling people who are considering suicide. And the rate of suicide in my hometown went through the roof because farmers weren't coping with this drought. Loans were being foreclosed on. And the thing that makes me most angry about this discourse is it doesn't make business sense, because those farmers could be being incentivised to turn over the unproductive land to solar panels. And what comes when you've got a drought? Heaps of sunshine. So this to me isn't about politics. This is actually about people's livelihoods, and it's about whether or not Australia wants to be a leader or whether it wants to be a laggard. And it's not so much a laggard politically, but a laggard economically. the globe is changing. The green economy is here, whether you believe in climate change or not. The money is starting to move. The venture capital is starting to move. We've even got the insurance industry, which is the largest gatherer of capital in the world, and mind you, should be the biggest voice when we're talking about sea level rise and climate change because of the impacts on their business model. They're both looking at the risk side of things, but they're also looking at the opportunity. They're starting to invest in solar. Allianz just spent $2 billion on a wind farm in France. So I guess that's the, you know, we can talk about the views of political leaders, and I never mind someone saying, hey, I kind of disagree with you. You know, I need a bit more information. But standing directly in the way of one-way traffic and saying, I want you to completely turn around and go exactly the way that no one else is going, that's not fair.
Brian, dealing with skeptics.
I think Inhofe may be calling Abbott to testify at his next Environment Committee hearing. I mean, I think, you know, I'm really fortunate in Boston. We're a science-based city and a science-based state. And, you know, I think unfortunately the politics is trailing public opinion. And I think there were some seminal moments in New York at the UN conference in terms of the diversity of the march in the studies that Pew put out afterwards on public understanding of climate change being here with us now and impacting us today. And I think that, you know, the politics is catching up to that. I think it's incredibly unfortunate that, you know, by and large, science is a competitive advantage and a differentiator and a bipartisan issue, and yet on this particular issue, we use the word around belief for things that are scientific. And, you know, that this is, you know, the national body of, or the international body of evidence that has been created scientifically around this, the National Academy of Sciences now says, is stronger than the body of evidence behind smoking causing cancer. We don't ask people if they believe in smoking causing cancer. We have hundreds of millions of dollars being traded in courts of law settlement around that defined proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it is very unfortunate that the politics has become so challenging. And I would echo Aaron's comments that it is so unfortunate, not only because they're wrong, right, the skeptics are wrong, but it's a win-win. The solutions are better cities, more energy independence, more livable cities, more social equity, more environmental friendliness. It's a better place to live, and we're fighting against this but for a very defined small set of big business interests.
Somehow the skeptics have to be convinced that climate change is profitable. And I think you would see a change in the national attitude if they believe that money can be made. I think the science community started off incorrectly by calling it global warming, because that term clearly doesn't exist in all parts of the world, but climate change does. We in Elizabeth, New Jersey, have suffered some of the most severe winters. You know, Morristown, where Washington was encamped years ago, you read those stories about how bad it was. Well, we suffer through those winters. But we can also suffer through a winter where we get 70 degrees in January and you can play golf. Mm-hmm. So global warming was a category that clearly helped defeat this process early on. Yep. Climate change, however, is real. It is happening, and mayors see that. Mayors see that, whether it be through the ability to pump. Our city has an awful lot of pumping stations in order to remove the water. We have a river called the Elizabeth River that runs through our city, and the pumping stations get to remove this water in flooded conditions. The Army Corps of Engineers came in there in the 60s and 70s and banked the river. But climate change is forcing the water back onto our shores. Upstream from the Elizabeth River eventually is going to cause the Elizabeth River to overflow because of issues that happen in other parts of the state, and we're going to be back into the same position where we were, where some areas may flood in our city again. So I think the skeptics are people who don't deal with the issue, and they clearly have the ability to pontificate. If you look at our Congress, which it sounds like your prime minister has the same problems. If you look at our Congress, they pontificate for political position in order to enhance their ability to get reelected. They have no concept of what it's like to be a mayor and to accomplish something.
Yep. Accountability.
Yeah, it's accountability. Absolutely. Yep.
For one last lighter moment of maybe one-liners here, when you in the past, and I'm sure you all have faced this situation, been standing in front of the person you consider to be the biggest climate change sea level rise skeptic that you've ever met? What's the best one-liner that you've had?
Oh.
Have you ever had one?
Can I say? Well, I don't know if I can say one. Look, I won't use a one-liner, but, you know, when skeptics of any nature come out to me, I can say, look, you can have your belief system however crazy I think it is, but I'd rather put my lot with Bloomberg, Rockefeller, NASA, CSIRO than an opinion writer in a two-bit newspaper who's telling me that climate change is not happening.
So, you know, when you want to get off the magic teacup ride and exit Fantasyland and join the rest of us?
We can have a conversation. Mayor?
There was a guy that was excommunicated because he said the world was round in the year 1600. And clearly the Catholic Church figured out a way to get him back in when the world was round. So... I think I would tell him, you know, science is right. You got to understand, science is right, and there's changes happening in this climate. So I'd point to that guy. His name escapes me, but somebody's got to know it.
I did. Look, this is actually not a very nice one, but I'll relay it anyway. There was someone who was trying to tell me that CO2 is natural. And I said, that's fine, so is arsenic. And I said, if you don't think CO2 can poison you and act as a pollutant, put a bag over your head.
On that note,
thank our panelists, if you would. Elizabeth, New Jersey, Mayor Christian Volwage. Melbourne, Australia, City Councillor Aaron Wood. Brian Sweat, the Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space for Boston Mayor Marty Walsh at City Hall. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a panel discussion titled How Coastal Cities Are Preparing and Adapting to Rising Sea Levels. Our discussion was co-sponsored by the Boston University Initiative on Cities and the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. Tonight's moderator was WBUR's Bob Oakes. We began with an introduction by Pardee Center Director Anthony Genados. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.